the enormity of the ribeyes and the strips and the chuck rolls off of them. I mean, you know, to give people an idea of what it could be like, you know, think if I'm looking at my computer screen right now and I have a laptop computer, and some of those ribeyes would probably cover, you know, the screen. They're so big. And that's where I think the beef industry, especially the NCBA and for us, the Kentucky Cattlemen's Association, have done a really good job of, okay, let's look at these cuts. Let's reimagine these cuts. Let's borrow some of these cutting techniques that's going on over in Europe. And so instead of doing a ribeye, let's start dissecting out the individual muscles, you know, the cap and the actual ribeye muscle itself, and creating some new cuts.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. bioMérieux is a world leader in the field of diagnostics for more than 60 years. From pathogen detection to genomics and data applications, bioMérieux helps beef industrials going beyond the test results to help control your food safety and process risks. Virbac, committed to growth. For information, visit vet-us.virbac.com/cattle or see your Virbac representative. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today. Healthy Farms by Bioverse, your manure management experts. Contact us for time and labor-saving solutions. Mycotoxins can threaten feed and cattle performance. DSM Firmenich offers a portfolio of solutions to help mitigate the impact of mycotoxins in your feed.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I'm your host, Brandy Buzzard, and it's my pleasure to bring you the latest trends and issues from the best and brightest minds in the beef industry. Today, we are joined by Dr. Greg Renfro, professor and extension meat specialist at the University of Kentucky. Dr. Renfro earned his master's in meat science from the University of Illinois and his PhD in meat science and muscle biology from the University of Missouri, and he has worked in the meat science industry through education, coaching, research, and extension for more than 35 years. We have a lot to talk about today, so let's dive right in. Dr. Renfro, welcome to the Beef Podcast. How are you?
I'm doing really good. We visited earlier. It's like it's the end of the semester here. It's a little bit safer crossing the street since it's a Friday. I don't know when this is going to air, but it's a Friday here. And about Wednesday is when it gets really dangerous crossing the street because those kids will run you over. They're ready to go home.
Well, for our listeners, we are recording this podcast on Friday, December 20th. So finals are, I'm assuming today is the last day of finals at the University of Kentucky.
Yep.
And so it's been a long time since I've been an undergrad, but I was itching to get out of there as well on those days. So we appreciate you taking the time. I personally appreciate you taking the time during finals.
My pleasure.
And to get started, you have been on the Beef Podcast before, but I did not have the pleasure of interviewing at that time. So if you want to start off with just bring us up to speed, or bring me up to speed on your background, how you got started in the meat industry, kind of your career. I know I listed a little bit in your bio, but that just is probably the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah. No, I guess I'm a little bit of an anomaly in meat science. Most meat scientists out there took a class and when they got into college and fell in love with there. I was 17, 18 years old. I don't remember which, late 80s. So that tells you how old I am. Working at a local grocery store, bagging groceries back when they actually bagged your groceries for you and put them in paper bags. So, So some of your younger listeners are probably saying, what in the world is a paper bag? And my father is now a retired high school ag teacher. And one of his former students was running the meat department in the grocery store I worked at and said, know your dad, know you're a pretty good kid. Why don't you come work for me back there? And it was only supposed to be just an after school job. And the next thing I know, it turned into a career. And a lot of people ask me, so how do you have 35, 36 years in the meats industry at your age? And I said, well, because I started when I was 17, 18 years old. So, I worked 14 years as a retail meat cutter, worked on it as a meat cutter when I was going through undergraduate. And then when I got accepted to grad school and I studied under Dr. Tom Carr and Dr. Floyd McKeith. And that's when I kind of stopped doing it retail, but I still continue to cut meat, trained a bunch of meat cutters. I think one time I've, I, I think it's got to be around 5,000 meat cutters that I've trained in the 36 years. Well, in all fairness, I mean, we have a meat cutting school here at UK, and our students get trained as well. I mean, I say trained that they know which end of knife to grab by the time the end of the semester. But when I worked for Walmart, you know, I trained a lot of meat cutters, worked for Walmart as well. So you know, and I've trained a lot of Kroger meat cutters. So it's got to be up there into thousands and thousands of meat cutters that I've trained over the years.
That's amazing. Not many people can say that. I mean, I just can't comprehend that. I think that's really, I don't know if a lost art, because it's not lost, but it really is an art.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. And that's one of the things that you know, I realized when I came here to UK, I realized two things: that growing up in the Midwest and then moving to the South, I didn't know I had an accent till I moved here. That was the one thing I realized. But one of the things I tapped on pretty quick is meat cutters and meat cutter training and so on. And you're right, it's somewhat of a lost art, because when I started in the late 80s, that's when box beef and box pork and all that stuff it became the standard. And the art of, you know, breaking down a whole side of beef or pork or lamb or whatnot, that was nobody knew how to do that unless you worked at like a small local meat processor. And to be honest with you, I didn't learn that till I got to the University of Illinois and working with Dr. McKeith. And so, but yeah, you're right. And that's one of the things I've been trying to do with my career, is trying to preserve that art, expand on that art. You know, it was really, it really kind of took off after the pandemic. You know, the pandemic kind of really spooked a lot of people that, you know, maybe I need to learn some of this stuff, especially, you know, I do a lot of work with the University of Maine. If I'm rambling on, just stop me. But
oh, you're doing great. I'm enjoying this.
Okay, cool. So, but I do a lot of work with University of Maine. And one of the clientele that I started working with in Maine, and oddly enough, they've starting to filter into our meat cutting schools down here. And that's these off the grid, you know, homesteader type folks. And I don't know about you, I've said this probably 100 times. If I'm going to live off the grid, Maine's the last place I'm going. My goodness, it's a beautiful state, don't get me wrong, but I remember Dr. Colt Knight, one time I texted him that there was a nor'easter that went through there in February. I said, "How much snow did you get?" And he said, 5 feet. Yeah. See, you about to spit your coffee out on that one.
I spit my drink out. Yes, I did. I wasn't.
Yeah, for I don't know about where you're at, but here we get 5 centimeters of snow, not 5 inches, 5 centimeters of snow, and it shuts the state down. And he's like, "Yeah, they don't really get concerned until they get like 2 feet of snow up there." So,
well, I live in Southeast Kansas. I live about an hour south of Kansas City, and we are much more. I mean, we get snow. We don't get 5 feet of snow. We usually, our winter this year, it's been cold, unseasonably cold for December, which has not been enjoyable. But usually I would say our winter doesn't start till about midway through January. And we usually get our blizzards in February, and we'll get snow, but not 5 feet. Like if we were to get a foot of snow, that would be huge. Like normally it's maybe 4 or 5 inches, 6 inches, something
like
that.
Yeah. But you still have people going to the store to get bread and milk, you know?
Yeah. We get a lot more actually. I mean, weather patterns are what they are, but we get a lot more ice. Like an ice storm is not. And sleep, that's not uncommon for us. I would say we probably get ice more often than snow.
Ice storm we had, my poor weeping willow looked like it was clinically depressed.
Speaking of, we were talking about finals weeks earlier and now ice storms. It was, I went to school at Kansas State University, and on Facebook, my memories have been popping up from all my friends. And in 2000, it was 2007. This last week would have been finals at K-State. There was a massive ice storm in Manhattan, Kansas. And it was so bad that they like closed the university. They closed the university kind of, but teachers were still giving finals. And so I remember I was in accounting too. One of my degrees is an ag econ. And you could either take the grade you had at the time, or you could stay and take your final and try to improve your grade. And I had a B, and I was like, I wanted all A's, but I was like, nope, don't care. I had no heat. Like, my house, a massive tree had fallen down on the street to get to my house, so I couldn't even stay at my house. My fish froze because the heat went out in the house and I forgot to go get it. Couldn't get to the house to save the fish. So I was like, I'll take my B and I'll leave. And so that was another, and you know, that's an ice storm in Kansas in December for you. So
yeah. Yeah. We get them too. We get them too.
Time, so, but yeah, that's, the meat cutting, back to the meat cutting art.
Yeah.
I know how to cut meat. I'll buy like a pork loin and we'll cut that up in the pork chops at our house. But my husband was on the meat judging team at K-State and later coached it and coached, or didn't coach the meat judging team. He coached the meat animal eval team.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're familiar with. And he took some advanced meat science classes in grad school. And I didn't realize how, like, I mean, I think if I had thought about it, I would have realized how technical it was. But I mean, he would have to go in and his test would be 3 hours, you know, breaking down a side of beef in the lab there at K-State, and just how not only physically demanding it is, but like, there's, you know, for those who are listening who've never cut up meat, there's not like, you know, there's not like a sign that says cut here to make this, you know, it's recognizing ligaments and muscles and striations in the meat, things like that. And it's so much more technical than I had understood. And my husband's grandpa was actually a butcher and one of his, a meat cutter. I don't know. Can you use those terms interchangeably? Is that okay? Butcher, meat cutter, the same thing? I don't know.
To me, they're one and the same. So.
Yeah. And then one of his cousins owns a locker and they cut meat. And so there's a lot of that kind of like, you know, in his family tree. And it's just very, gosh, it's very, very technical and demanding and not something that I knew when I first, you know, started learning about it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you're absolutely right. You know, there, you go online, you see the schematics with the dotted lines, you'll cut here and here and here, and they don't have that on there. For me, I'm a little bit of the black sheep in the family. And I say that, you know, tongue in cheek, because, you know, I mentioned my dad is a retired ag teacher. Mm-hmm. You know, he was a row crop guy, you know, Central Illinois, we were row crop people, the family farmers, row crops. And, you know, I do remember my dad saying that he was my grandfather and the family had dairy cattle. And when my dad decided to go to college, my grandfather got rid of the dairy cattle and went straight to row crop. So everybody on my dad's side of the family, they're all row crop, corn, soybeans, wheat, you know, and then here comes his son, who's an animal scientist, meat scientist, and so on and so forth. But he always used me as an example. I didn't find this out the years later. It's like, never discount an after school job. You never know what's going to happen. And he tells a story about me, you know, ended up being a professor and teaching other people how to cut meat. And it literally was supposed to be an after school job. You know, so, but,
how great is that to find something you're so passionate at such a young age?
Yeah.
And enjoy it for 3 decades. Like, I mean, there's a lot of people working in positions and careers that they don't love.
You're right. And I'm really fortunate here at UK because I'm able to not only do the extension stuff, which I enjoy. Don't get me wrong. I like doing research, but I don't find it as rewarding as I do with the extension stuff. But I'm able to teach, you know, so I'm carrying on that kind of, you know, from father to son type thing with teaching. And I enjoy teaching. You know, I told my department chair just yesterday, I said, you know, if you ask me to do something administratively or something like that, I'm going to say, as long as I can still teach, you know, I really enjoy that, you know. And you're right. You made a comment earlier that kind of, you know, popped in my head. Yeah, meat cutting is a little tough on your body. It really is, you know, and especially nowadays, you know, and I'm sure you've probably interviewed people that talked about this as well, is the size of cattle have gotten so big, you know, and when I was on the meats judging team and the meats judging alumni out there are going to remember this, but you know, we had that value-based carcass pricing class, and your husband probably remembers that. And when I was on the meats judging team, I think you discounted the carcasses if I remember right, it was 900 pounds. You had to discount it. Yeah. And now that's like 950 to 900 pounds is about our average. So it's really, you know, it shows you how things have come along since then. But yeah, guys that do this for a long time, like some of the guys that trained me, they had steel plates in their back, they had carpal tunnel and stuff like this. Because you're working in the cold and you're on wet floors and you're using your back a lot and your hands a lot and so on and so forth. And
the hands.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you said that's how you get the carpal tunnel, and it's dangerous because, you know, the knives are supposed to be sharp, you know. Yeah. And I say supposed to be, you know. It's like, yeah, the old adage is you're going to cut yourself with a dull knife. Yeah, you will, but when you cut yourself with a sharp knife, it does a lot more damage than those dull knives do. So
about that, just to circle to the comment about carcass weight, we sell a lot of freezer beef. One of the kind of arms of our ranch business is selling freezer beef. And like when I sell the beef to the butcher, we get discounted for carcass. Like I get, you know, I have to pay more processing if it's over, I think if it's over 900 pounds, it's either 850.
Yeah,
or 900,
yeah.
I've got to pay fees over that. And my husband is a PhD. He has a PhD in animal nutrition. And so he's really good at feeding cattle. And so we're trying to like, this is great. You're doing really great, but like, I've got to send these and I don't want to have to pay extra money on processing. So can we dial it back a bit? But it is, I always, for some reason, I don't know why, like we get our own beef butchered, but I buy beef from the grocery store. Cause you know, there's only so many steaks on a carcass, you know, this. And
yeah,
we go to a restaurant and on the odd chance that I order a steak from a restaurant, you know, you get, you know, an appropriately sized portion, you know, maybe like a 10-ounce ribeye. And then I get beef that we get from butchered from our own animals. And like last night we had some strip steaks and I mean, you can see the carcasses are bigger, are getting bigger because our family of four, we have two young daughters. We ate two strip steaks was plenty for the four of us, you know, because they're not restaurant portioned out. They're just,
strip
steak.
Yeah.
And it always sort of shocks me, even though I know about it, like to see the actual cut off the animal and how it ends up in the grocery store. There's all sorts, I'm sure you know this, there's all sorts of, you know, workshops and, you know, discussions at cattle meetings across the nation about like, are we making cattle too big because groceries, like restaurants can't sell or don't want to sell an 18-ounce ribeye or whatever, like, you know, things like that nature. So it's definitely a dichotomy.
Yeah, it is. And you're absolutely right. Cause it's interesting that you brought that up with the size of this cuts, you know, and I was, you know, from the health side, you know, lugging around a 450 pound side of beef, you know, that kind of wears on an old man like me. But, I just did my performance stuff for my evaluation. And I had, in the last 2 years, I've done 16 ribeye and chuck roll cutting demonstrations where we talk about that, like exactly what you said, the enormity of the ribeyes and the strips and the chuck rolls off of them. I mean, you know, to give people an idea of what it could be like, you know, think if I'm looking at my computer screen right now and I have a laptop computer and some of those ribeyes would probably cover, you know, the screen
that
they're so big. And that's where I think the beef industry, especially the NCBA and for us, the Kentucky Cattlemen's Association, have done a really good job of, okay, let's look at these cuts. Let's reimagine these cuts. Let's borrow some of these cutting techniques that's going on over in Europe. And so instead of doing a ribeye, let's start dissecting out the individual muscles, you know, the cap and the actual ribeye muscle itself, and creating some new cuts. And I do a lot of those cutting demonstrations. And that's, you know, I tell them, I say, folks, you got to realize to a retail meat cutter, this ribeye is a sacred object. All right. You don't do what I'm going to do to this thing. But, and I couch it as by saying, you got to realize too, that if you look at the generation, this is one thing that's kind of a side pet project of mine is looking at generations. So I'm talking about baby boomers, me as a Gen Xer, millennials, and Generation Z, not only how they buy food, you know, being an educator, I look at them how they learn, you know, and they like to be taught, but how they buy food, how they eat food. And then you look at the beef industry as a whole, and beef prices are up. You know, everything is up. That's why we have this new phrase or new word called sizeflation. And, you know, my dad, who's a baby boomer, my mom, who's a baby boomer, when they're the ones that have the disposable income to buy the ribeyes and the strip steaks and so on and so forth. But you're right. If you want to, you know, out of some of these ribeyes and strips that come off these big cattle, if you want a 10 ounce portion, you know, you're talking about a half inch thick. But if you want a 6 ounce portion, you're probably talking about maybe a sandwich slice of ribeye off there. And nobody wants that when they go out.
Those
new beef cuts like the ribeye filet and the cap steak and reimagining, you know, the other thing I can tell you for certain, if I said the ribeyes would cover this computer screen here that I'm looking at, a sirloin off of that would be double the size. And I worked with one of our grocery store chains here, and we talked about cutting those sirloins, the big ones, cutting them in thirds and then making, you know, sirloin fillets out of them, because people like that word fillet. But it gives, as a retailer, you know, it gives you more rings going through the cash register, because I can almost guarantee you 99.9% of the people shopping in a grocery store cannot tell you price per pound of hamburger or the ribeyes or any of that. They know the total price. That's where their eyes go, is to the total price. And I can tell you, in the late 80s and early 90s, when I started cutting meat retail, we could put two ribeyes in a package. I haven't seen that in decades.
Oh, you know? Right. Yeah.
You know, and we used to cut whole rounds. And, you know, you think about, like, a student of mine brought some of her cattle in, we processed them, and they were 1500 pounds, and the rounds that came off them things, they were huge. They were monstrous. And that's why you don't see whole round steaks in grocery stores either. But it is cool that the NCBA and the Kentucky Cattlemen's Association and everybody's state associations are working on ways of reimagining things, and it forces the traditional meat cutter to step out of his comfort zone and say, okay, yeah, we cut the ribeyes this way, but we need to rethink that, you know. And the chuck roll is another prime example of, yeah, this time of year people pull out that crock pot and they like to put that big chuck roast in there, but in the summertime nobody wants to do that. But if I take and dissect that guy out, and I get Denver cuts, and I get the ribeye or the Delmonico's or the chuck eye steaks, and then you get the country style ribs off those as well. That creates a lot more opportunities for our meat cutters. And one last thing on this subject, I got to tell this story, because this generation thing, you know, fascinates me, because I teach Generation Z now. So you got a Gen Xer teaching Generation Z, and just this last year, I showed a class. I said, this is how we do the new way of doing the ribeyes. And this one girl says, oh, I like those ribeye fillets. I said, really? And she goes, yeah, my dad eats ribeyes, but I'm going to eat a ribeye fillet. So there's a little bit of that, still that kind of rebellious nature in our consumers and our students and our kids, you know?
Yeah. You mentioned the sirloins, like one sirloin steak off of one of our steers will feed our whole family. Like, they are massive. And like,
yeah, and probably with leftovers too.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, it's the next night we're having hash, like steak and potato hash.
But, you know, taking that sirloin, you know, the dovetail on what you're saying there, the cool thing is now, to reduce that portion size, now I pull that cap off the top of that rib or that sirloin, and I get that thing that everybody loves to go to in that Brazilian steakhouse, is that picanha. In the U.S., we call it a culotte, but it now gives me another cut.
Yeah,
gives me another cut. And then especially when you're showing people, you peel that off and you say, okay, this is, we call it a culotte, you know, or the Brazilians call it a picanha. And they're like, what? And then I say, if you go into a Brazilian steakhouse and they bring out the beef and it's wrapped around that sword, that's what this is, you know?
Oh, okay.
And then all of a sudden that creates even more interest, because, oh, I can have exactly what I had at a Brazilian steakhouse.
Yeah. I should know this, and I'm embarrassed that I don't, because I sell a lot of beef. But we love stew meat in our house. I don't make stew with it, we marinate it and stick it on kebabs and have
kebabs with it. Yeah.
This is not a paid plug, but I love Allegro marinade. It's like the best.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
But stew meat, is that a roast just chunked?
Yes and no. It's usually just whole muscle cuts that are not heavily, have a lot of marbling or fat on them that we cut from the animal. And that's one of those things that you talk about cutting meat as a lost art. It's one thing to cut meat. It's another thing to sit down and look at that piece of meat in front of you and say, how do I cut this for profit? How do I make the most money out of it? And you're absolutely right. You get the stew meat. And we did this in, when I worked retail. Or I could take my hand and flip it and goes into ground beef. Well, if I can sell ground beef for $3 a pound, yet I take that same piece that I would have flipped over to make ground beef for $3 a pound, I could cut it up and now it's $3.50 a pound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, little things like that, you know, because, you know, you know, that's another thing that a lot of people forget. And we always talk about that is being able to cut meat for a profit, you know, looking at that and say, okay, I can do this, but I can also do this and make more money off of it.
Yeah, I was looking, you're absolutely right. It's definitely a value added cut because I don't want to make stew, but I will use the stew meat to make kebabs, and you got to cook it medium rare because it doesn't have as much marbling. So you cook it more than that and it's very tough. But I was open, as you were talking there, I was opening what we charge for like individual cuts. And I thought I had stew meat on here, but I don't. But it's definitely, it's more like I have people request stew meat and I don't want to sell it because like we want to use it. And there's only so many packets of it, you know, that you get in a quarter. Yeah. And so I will sell it, but I don't love it too because we eat it. So we do the roast in the winter, like what you were saying, you know, I love it when we get like a 3-pound chuck roast because my family loves roast. I have a roast recipe that they just love, but I'm not making roast in the summer. And so it's nice to have on the flip side to have some stew meat. And so I was just curious. I didn't know if it was basically a stew meat was a roast reformed.
It can be, but it's usually just the good trimmings and so on and so forth. But you know, you brought up another thing that I thought would be kind of cool to talk about, selling your own freezer beef. You know, that is a huge thing, and you'll have to excuse me for not knowing my, you know, programs in Kansas, but here in Kentucky, we have this thing called Kentucky Proud, and it is the promotion of all the products that are made and grown and whatnot here in Kentucky. And, you know, and we now, myself and one of the ag economists I work with, we classify a certain consumer as called a local vore. Those people that are searching for those kind of things. And, you know, and we do a lot of programming, you know, extension programming around freezer beef. And it caught fire when it was the local program, and then the pandemic hit and it really caught fire with the freezer beef.
Oh yeah. You know, so. I'm looking at this sheet here again, just to see like what, cause prices have gone up, but I'm looking at what I have, like what we charge for it. And then I have like comparison of other ranches in Kansas, like what that are kind of close to us that do the same kind of thing. And then I also have like Walmart on here, and I need to update it because like on here, ground beef, we sell it. It's about 90-10 what we sell, but like ground beef at Walmart, a comparable thing would be like 93.7. And when I priced it, it was $5.84 a pound. And I just sold yesterday, I sold 80 pounds of our ground beef. And I just looked up what Walmart was selling it for the 93.7 yesterday, just as a comparison, like, are we still making money on this price that I'm pricing these people? Yeah. And it was like $6.97. So I need to go through and update my entire spreadsheet because it's outdated now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's one of the things that I work with a colleague of mine, love him like a brother, Dr. Kenny Burdine. I always send people to him because if you're going to do this local freezer beef, like you're talking about, our farmer's market, we have people that just do stuff at farmer's market as well. You know, you got to be able to make money.
Yeah.
And which you're fighting is, yeah, you're right. Looking at Walmart and looking at IGA or Kroger or Publix or whatever you want to look at, you know, just insert whatever local grocery store you have in there and you see their price. You know, you got to realize those guys have economies of scale.
Yes.
You know, when like one of the stores that I worked at, you know, we bought semi loads of meat in at the grocery store. So big difference when you're buying semi loads versus buying one side of beef. And that's the one thing I always caution folks like you that are doing this, these freezer beef local products, is to sit down with an ag economist and make sure you're making money. You know, and I know I've dealt with farmers my whole entire life. Oh, my hay doesn't cost me anything because I have the baler and the tractor. Well, I don't know a baler that doesn't break down. I don't know a tractor that doesn't break down. Everything needs diesel fuel.
You need fuel.
You may not be buying the hay, but it's still costing you money and so on. And so, you know, usually local products, you know, freezer beef programs like you're talking about, you're looking at probably a 30 to 35% more than what you're going to see in your grocery store. And a lot of people get a little upset at that. You know, why do I have to charge that much to make money? You're not buying semi loads of meat. That's the thing, is that economy is a scale thing that people always forget about there.
We got started on the ranch, and you didn't ask for any of this background, but you're kind of a captive audience now. So, we got started, when we first started at the ranch in like 2015 or 2016, we would sell like a couple head of freezer beef. It was one that didn't fit marketing or whatever, you know, and we would just sell to family, friends, or keep for ourselves or something like that. And then pandemic happened, and I remember seeing the grocery store shelves and how quickly they emptied. And I was like, I think that we need to, I mean, I don't want to say like we capitalize on an opportunity, because that sounds so absolutely horrible, but we recognize there is going to be a need for beef. People are going to want to eat beef, and there's not going to be any at the grocery store. So I called sometime like probably middle or end of March in 2020 and got as many butcher appointments as I could for that year.
Oh yeah.
And it has been, I mean, I think I probably market close to 27 or 28 ahead a year, and we're going to expand that next year as well. Probably closer to like 34, 35 next year, which there's a lot of people who sell that, you know, in the 3-month period, but that's a lot for us, because our main arm of the business is selling bulls and heifers. So, you know, we're not focused only on freezer, but we do mostly quarters and halves, sell a little bit by a pound. Like if someone wants to buy like 10 pounds of hamburger and a couple roasts, we do that. But it's definitely like you're talking about, like the fuel and the baler and the land cost and things, but like, it's also your time.
Yes.
It takes a lot of time to, I do not go to farmers markets. I just refuse to donate that much to not donate, but to spend that much time on it.
Yeah. Like,
I just don't want to do that, but it takes a lot of time.
I can tell you stories.
You got to market it. And then, you know, a lot of people don't understand, and it's not their fault. You don't know what you don't know, but a lot of people don't understand, like, okay, this is the cost of the meat and you got to pay the processor. We have since rolled it all into one lump sum, so I don't have to explain pricing by the pound and all that. It's just easier that way. You got to walk people through cut orders and, you know, this is how long it's going to hang. And the hanging weight is going to be of this quarter is going to be 200 for math's sake, but you're not going to get 200 pounds of meat. And it just takes time to do that. So not only are you pricing in the fact of like all your inputs, but you got to price in your time. And it's also, you know, it's a premium product. Like it's not any healthier or safer than the grocery store beef, but it is a premium product. It hangs. It has it's a higher, a lot of times it's a more robust flavor, I would say. And so you have to add that into the pricing, because you're exactly right. If you're not doing that, you're losing money, and you may not think about it if you don't look at all of your inputs of your time and all that. So,
and I learned a phrase, you know, very, very intelligent, very nice, very sweet woman by the name of Laura Freeman. And the rest of the world knows it as Laura's Lean. You know, she's here in Kentucky, you know, and Laura Freeman said something to me one time that always stuck with me. And I don't think I'm going to pick on farmers in general, whether they're beef farmers or pork farmers or row crop farmers, but it's every businessman. People get confused and they think cash flow and profit are the same thing. And she always said that there's a difference between cash flow and profit. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, that's a really brilliant thing to say. That really is. And that's where people forget that, you know. Well, the money's always coming in, so I must be making money. No, it's just money's coming in.
It feels good to have that money coming in. I just, the beef that we butchered in late November, people are picking up right now, like picking up this week. We had a lot of people who wanted to buy a quarter beef or whatever for their family as a gift, which is great. That's wonderful. Please keep doing that.
Yeah.
But that, you know, all that money is coming in right now. And so, you know, I'm transferring that to our account and things, and it looks great. But like, I know that that quarter beef that probably, you know, I think one of them, the quarter beef was like $7.80 or something like that.
Yeah.
That's not pure profit. Like there's, you know, that cash is coming in, but I know that's not pure profit because all the, you know, we grain finish. So all the grain, the hay that they're eating, feed them some silage. That, I mean, it's, you're exactly right. And if you don't have that lens on, you're just, I don't know. You're not kicking yourself. You're not shooting yourself in the foot or anything like that, but there's a different, it's a different viewpoint for sure. So
And I would venture to say too, and correct me if I'm wrong, you probably have people that approach you and say, I would love to buy a quarter of beef, love to buy a side of beef, but my freezer is what's above my refrigerator.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you don't have a whole lot of folks that have those deep freezes in the basement or in the garage or something like that. And one of the things that we've had some success with here in the bluegrass is this thing called a beef share. So if you have somebody, you know, and you shake your head like you know what I'm talking about, but the listeners may not, but that's one of those things where maybe your freezer's above your refrigerator, but I bet your neighbor's that way too, and your other neighbor's that way, and maybe four or five of you go together to buy that. And we've actually heard it to where it's become kind of a social thing where the meat comes in and they get together, and here in Kentucky, we pour bourbon, you know, but some people may crack a beer or wine, but here in Kentucky, we have bourbon. So, and they'll pour that and they'll just divvy it. And you know, you may say, well, I really were interested in ground beef. And you're like, okay, you get all the ground beef. I'll take the, you know, the steaks and so on and so forth. And we always liken it, you know, 'cause again, it's Kentucky. The horse that crosses the finish line at the Kentucky Derby probably has 20 owners, you know, and that's kind of what this beef is just multiple people have gone into it. And it's a way for people to get the local product because in reality, they're buying your beef, but they want to be able to tell their friends, I know the farmer that this came from. I know the farm and so on and so forth. Yeah. And they're buying your story more than anything, especially in these local products. They're buying your story more than anything. So, you know, and that's all, one thing we always tell folks is if you can't do it, find four or five other people that want to go in on that. So,
For sure. And we have had people that have said, you know, I want to buy a quarter beef, but like, it's either they don't have the freezer space or they don't have that because it is an investment. It's not cheap to buy a quarter beef. It's cheap when you compare it by the pound, like how much beef you get compared to buying it by the pound at a grocery store. Like the value is there.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it is a lot of upfront cost. Like I totally get that. And so that's why we started selling the cuts individually. We are USDA certified in the state of Kansas. And so I can sell 5 pounds of hamburger and a roast out of our freezer space here. But that's why we started doing that, because people wanted our beef, but they're like, I can't take a whole quarter. I've got like a freezer above my fridge. And so I have not ever had anybody do a beef share. But I think like if someone wanted to do that, I wouldn't be opposed to it. But they need to find their buddies and do it because
exactly.
And trying to find people to like go.
Yeah. And you'll probably fully admit this. Doing what you're doing with the freezer beef, it's probably turned into a part-time job, if not another full-time job.
Yeah, well, I'm self-employed, so that is helpful that I don't, I'm not trying to do this in the margins of the day, you know, not trying to sell freezer beef in the margins of time outside of 8 to 5. So that is helpful. But like we talked about earlier, it's time consuming. And I don't deliver beef because from a safety standpoint, it's probably not safe for me to drive into Kansas City by myself as a woman alone to someone I've never met and be like, here's some beef. But also just from a time standpoint, like I just don't have enough time. I could make the time to do that, but that's not what I choose to do with my time in terms of that. So,
and I drove in Kansas City and it's not the easiest city to drive in. So.
Well, it's not the difficulty of driving. Like I drive a truck and a big trailer through Kansas City all the time. It's just like, I don't really need to go meet strangers in the Walmart parking
lot. I'm with you.
So that's not,
I'm with you.
I shouldn't do that. So, I mean,
kind of makes you feel a little bit like a drug dealer, doesn't it?
A little bit.
Meet me in a Walmart parking lot.
Yeah. Always meet in a public place. So, but yeah, it's not a full-time job for me, but it could be. I mean, I have some friends. I met them on, they were a guest on the podcast and now we've kind of become social media friends and like their entire job is selling beef. And they're expanding. They have the feeder cat, like, and it is, I mean, they spend more time obviously doing it than they would if they had an 8-to-5 job, but it's what they love to do.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
Want beef, yep. And buy beef. And that's what they ship beef as well. I'm not shipping either. Cause for me to drive somewhere, I've got to drive 25 minutes just to get the
dry ice.
I got to drive 25 minutes just to get the dry ice. And then another probably 25 minutes beyond that to get to like a UPS or a FedEx that could accommodate like a 2-day shipping. So I'm satisfied with selling our 30-ish head here. People like it. I don't really ever think I want to expand to 50 head.
And it's a truck payment.
Well, I had this whole big long list of like trends about meat processing and transparency, sustainability we were going to go through. But you're going to have to come back for a third episode because
yes, absolutely.
I just truly, truly enjoyed this and just having a conversation.
It's time for our famous three.
Is stress affecting your bottom line? Even routine handling, inclement weather, weaning, and dietary changes can significantly lower the rumen pH, causing cortisol levels to spike. Cortisol not only compromises the immune system, but also suppresses normal appetite and feed consumption. The solution? Cattle Active. Increase production and reduce the impacts of stress on your cattle for cents a day. Cattle Active restores the balance naturally. Want to learn more how a feeding program including Cattle Active can improve both profits and herd health? Visit us today at proearthanimalhealth.com. Be proactive with Cattle Active.
But I do, that is all the time that we have for the episode today. So thank you. Oh, I have closing questions, actually. I'm supposed to ask these of every guest. And I usually I give the guest a heads up before we start recording. And I completely forgot to do that to you today. So
that's no problem. I'm extension, so I can think on my feet. Okay. So.
Well, these will be off the cuff. So the first one we ask these of every guest is, what is your favorite, I usually say beef or cattle-related resource, but for you, we'll say like beef, cattle, or meat-related resource, like a book or a website. Or I had one guy answer that his wife was his favorite beef-related resource because she did all like the genetic planning and things like that.
Well, I tell you, for me, the meat buyer's guide, which I just found out a couple of weeks ago that the American Meat Science Association, I swear I know how to talk. They've taken that over from the North American Meat Processors, but that's a good resource for me. I've been doing this for 36 years and so on and so forth, but somebody will ask me something and it's like, what in the world are you talking about? And after I pretend like I know what I'm doing, I'll go back and look at that buyer's guide to get an idea of that kind of stuff. So that's the one resource that I keep pretty handy for me.
Okay. I can say I've never had that answer before. So congratulations that you are one of one on that.
Yeah. I also use our meat inspector too downstairs to answer questions too.
Oh, that's so good too. That's also a good person to ask.
Yep.
Okay. So what is your favorite non-beef or non-meat related book or one that you are currently reading?
Okay. Well, you're going to love this. So I have a tradition. There's two books I'm reading right now. And one of them is I've read it before. It's a little bit of a challenge to read. It is a book that has been made into countless number of movies and TV shows, but it's A Christmas Carol.
Oh,
Try to read that around Christmas time. And the reason why I say it's a challenge to read, because it's written in that old English and that old English slang there. But the other one, and this is going to make me sound like a literary geek, but I've always wanted to do it. We were in a bookstore about a month and a half ago, and you know you're reading a book when you have to, you read it and then you go online to figure out what you just read. And that's the Divine Comedy.
Oh, okay.
Which is Dante's Inferno, yes. Purgatorio, and Paradiso. So I am reading that book, and it's something I always wanted to do, you know, being a Catholic and a religious guy and so on and so forth. And so I'm about three quarters of the way through the first Dante's Inferno, you know, I have put it on the shelf so I can read A Christmas Carol. But my modus operandi is about 9 o'clock at night, you know, I turn the TV off, I go back and lay in bed and read for about an hour, hour and a half, and then go to bed, go to sleep. So
that's a nice way to go.
And usually my wife's taking a bath, so she's doing her thing and I'm doing my thing.
Yeah. Well, that's nice. I have not read Dante's Inferno, but my husband took it was called Great Books at K-State. And that was one of the books that he was reading. He liked it. So he found it very memorable. So,
yeah, it is. And what's neat about it is it does force you to think, okay, is this what hell is really going to be like? You know, I hope it's not what it's going to be like for me, but you know, but as you know, but it's also really kind of interesting because, you know, you could tell the author didn't like a few people, and you're like, who is this person? You look it up, it's like, well, you know, the author Dante, he didn't like this guy pretty much, and so yeah. So when he died, he put him in hell, you know. So that's kind of funny there. I guess it's a little bit of passive aggressiveness there. So
I think I need to move it up my reading list. Sounds like
You download the reader's guide to it so you can understand what you're reading.
Okay. Well, that's good. Okay. So the last one is, when you think of someone you admire or look up to, what is a characteristic they possess that has led them to be successful?
For me, and I guess this comes from being a PhD, but that the intelligence and ability to take that intelligence and take something so difficult and be able to explain it to a high school class, school class or something like that, where they understand it. And I have been blessed over the years with the mentors that I've had, you know, Drs. Floyd McKee, Tom Carr. I studied under Dr. Eric Berg when I was at Missouri, and he's now at North Dakota State University. But that's what those guys were able to do. They were super intelligent guys, but they could sit down and talk to a farmer, a meat cutter, a meat processor, and say words like myoglobin, but be able to explain it to where they could understand it. And that's something that I've always tried to do, you know, as an extension specialist, you know. Well, you know, pork's blood is pink. No, pork's blood is not pink. It's red. No, it's pink in the package. I said, well, you've got water and myoglobin and so on. And then you have to explain that to them. You got to make it to where they understand it. And that's the thing that I've always admired about folks. And I work with a lot of great people that are able to do that. And I admire that ability to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's definitely an intangible but very valuable skill to have. For sure. Yeah. Well, that is all the time and questions we have for today. Dr. Renfro, thank you so much for joining. I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation with you. I hope that the audience has enjoyed it as well, as we've just chatted back and forth about all things meat and freezer beef. If listeners have questions about you or your extension work or programs, or if they want to learn more about our discussion today, where can they do that? Where would you like to? Is there a web page or?
Yeah, I'm always open to email. I don't do social media. I'm thoroughly convinced in the book of Revelations when it says so many will be saved, it's going to be those of us that are not on social media. I thought that was a good joke. I guess not. But
doesn't bode well for me. So
if you just go to the University of Kentucky webpage and you could type in my name, GREGG. RENTFROW is my last name. and you'll get my email address and you can email me. And I'm more than happy to answer a lot of emails. In fact, that's why you kind of see me looking off to my left here, is because the emails have been rolling in. And so I always try to stay on top of answering emails.
Again, thank you for coming on the show, Dr. Renfro. It was wonderful to meet you.
My pleasure.
And thank you to our audience for being here and for tuning in. And we'll meet you back here next week on the Beef Podcast.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.